Hey, everybody, I'm Nick Layton.
And I'm Leah Bonema.
And we're the hosts of Were You Raised by Wolves?
Each week, we try to make the world a kinder, nicer place.
Well, that's the idea, at least.
I mean, we try.
Have you ever wondered what to do if you're ghosted?
Or what to do when a friend asks you to borrow money?
Or the proper way to eat Cheetos?
You know, the big questions.
So please find Were You Raised by Wolves wherever you listen.
This episode is brought to you by Diageo Bar Academy. Learn more at diageobaracademy.com. Well, hello, welcome to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer, and it is Monday, November 8th, 2021. This show will be airing in a couple of days, and it is our 308th episode of this series, which is dedicated to behind-the-scenes talent in the hospitality industry. Today, my guest is an award-winning bartender who has flair, and I will introduce him fully in a moment. First, as I do in every show, I will start out with my PR tip, and then later, we will have my speed round game, industry news discussion, solo dining experience, and the final question. As the founder of Bayer Public Relations, I'm going to tip the show off with my PR tip of the week. So today's tip is to have showmanship. Yes, let's think like performers and bring style and flair to everything we do, making our act stand out from the rest. How we present ourselves and perform can make a difference, creating a new sense of excitement and appreciation for others and lifting spirits. So let's all embrace our best Hugh Jackman and aim to be the greatest showman or showwoman on earth. That's my tip today. Okay, I'm happy to have my guest joining me. We're going behind the bar today. My guest is Chris Cardone. He is a bartender with over 21 years of experience who is currently bartending at I Sodi, which is Rita Sodi's beloved Italian restaurant in New York City. Chris is the 2017 national champion of Diageo World Class, the world's largest global mixology competition, as well as a three-time national finalist. Chris is also a four-time national flair bartending finalist and has organized and judged bartending competitions of all styles all over the world since 2004. Without further ado, hi, Chris. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Sherry. Thank you very much for having me.
My pleasure. I'm excited to chat and hear all about your career and what's happening in the world of bartending. So I always like to start with my guests and find out how they got into the industry. So do you want to take us back a little bit, like what drew you into hospitality and bartending?
Sure, of course. So I started tending bar in the year 2000. I was a college kid living in Long Island and going to school in Pennsylvania. And I was in my break for winter. And I decided that I would take a bartending class to go back to school and bartend to make a couple bucks and, you know, pay tuition and all of the insane amounts of cost of going to college. And then I loved it so much. I went right after my junior year, I went right into the bar during the summer of between my junior and my senior year of college. And I worked at a place called The Roadhouse. And it doesn't exist anymore, but it sounds like the movie was. It was a rough, rough spot. And it was the best thing. You know, looking back at it, there's so many bartenders today that have never worked in a bar that requires you to learn how to really deal with guests on a more than what they want to drink level. So I mean, I was learning how to break up fights and calm people down and cut people off and remember their names and clean out their ashtrays. I mean, we're talking a long time ago. We're talking about a completely different style of bartending than what most people know today. And it was, like I said, it was the best thing for me because it learned how to teach me how to do all this stuff besides what was going inside the glass. And I've used that ever since to my advantage. And then, you know, from that point on, it's just been a kind of a wild ride. I opened up a couple bartending schools with a partner of mine back in the early 2000s, and we were doing that, and I thought that was going to be my path. Then I ended up realizing that that didn't make me truly happy, so I went back to full-time bartending and worked in restaurants and sports bars and nightclubs and even with catering companies, on-site, off-site, and finally broke into the mixology thing back in the early 2010s. I was lucky enough and fortunate enough to meet with Julie Reiner, and she gave me an opportunity to work at her, one of her places. And, you know, since then it's just been in Manhattan ever since, you know, running programs since 2013. I was at the Beatrice Inn for their grand opening as their head bartender, then moved on to another great spot, Il Buco Alimentari, for a little while. Then I got stolen from there to run the grand opening of a restaurant called White Street in Tribeca. And a little bit more than 6 years ago now, I got a recommendation to go speak to Rita at Esodi. And that's been my home away from home ever since.
Wow, amazing. I mean, that's a lot of experience. And yeah, I was going to ask you, like, who mentored you? And yeah, Julie Reiner's a great one. But that's, I mean, all those restaurants you named and talking about the early days of how cocktail or bartending culture was a bit different. But I recall those scenes as well, even though I wouldn't say I was behind the bar dealing with them.
Right.
But so talk a bit about Esodi, because I've dined there before. I'm definitely due to come back. It's a fabulous Italian restaurant, but it's from what I, you know, my description of it is it's quaint, it's low key. I mean, it's I would say it's the opposite of like a rowdy bar.
Oh, for sure. So it's a kind of a fun story how I got in there, because a friend of mine who was working there that I've worked with in multiple locations asked me to meet with her. And I sat down with her on a Sunday afternoon before the restaurant was open. And I don't think we talked about work at all. We just kind of, you know, talked about life and what I was looking for and what she was looking for in the industry. But we never really spoke about anything about the restaurant itself. I never really asked her any questions. She never really asked me any questions. And then she just kind of said, hey, listen, like, why don't you come in for, you know, a couple days to train and see what you think? And she was so confident about it that I was so impressed that I was like, okay, I'm definitely going to give this try. And 3 days later, she asked me, you know, what do you think? And I said, I'm in, you know, like I love her place. She's one of a rare kind of person in this business where she really understands the business aspect as well as understanding food and balance of flavor and doesn't get caught up in all of the hype that I think this industry unfortunately has really been too involved in. You know, there's too much PR, there's too much Instagram, there's too much trying to smoke and mirrors the business instead of understanding the foundation of what people really want when they go out to dinner. And that is just great food, great service, and a great time with each other. And that's it. So when you go to Esodi, it's not a big show. You know, there's nothing on the walls. There's no, you know, big plating and everybody's got to explain the 855 ingredients in your dish. It's just simple. It's here's your food. It's going to be great. Here's your service. We're going to do our great job. We're not going to interfere in your conversations. We're going to be kind of like almost shadows where we're in and out where you don't really notice us. And we're just, you know, hopefully going to give you a great dining experience with you and the guests that you're with so that you come back often. But again, it's a rare thing, I think, these days, the way she runs her business. And I'm always inspired by her because she's always the hardest worker. And I've worked in other spots where the owner of a restaurant or the executive chef of a restaurant didn't bring that attitude to work. They didn't come in as the hardest worker. It was very much more of a, I'm going to watch from the behind and I'm not going to be involved. And I'm just going to kind of point my finger and yell and blame and, you know, treat my place as a playground. And she's the exact opposite of that. You know, it's constant training. It's constantly, she's a constant presence and it's really, really exciting to work for her. I've learned more than I can imagine over these past 6 years.
Yeah, that's amazing. And nothing you're saying is surprising me from what I know about her. And it's wonderful to hear you say that. Let me ask you my question from my last guest. On episode 307, I had on Vicky Freeman, who's a partner of the Bowery Group, which includes Vic's, Cookshop, Rosie's, Shuka, and Shukette, all very market-driven restaurants in New York City, also very beloved. Mm-hmm. So she wants to know a couple of things. First, she said she lives down the block from Esodi and it's one of her favorite restaurants. And she actually wants to go there, she said next week, but it's really this week for her anniversary. So she wants to know how she can get in. Yeah. And her second question was, she's so impressed by the level of knowledge that everyone who works at ISOTI has, including about spirit. So she wants to know, how do you get your staff to be so educated? And she said she usually sits at the bar. So I assume you've probably met.
Oh, I'm sure of it. So to answer the first question, you know, that's another thing I love about ISOTI is that no one is treated differently than another person, in that there's nobody getting, you know, tables because they know somebody or because they're a celebrity or none of that stuff applies. You know, I've worked in other spots where if a celebrity comes in and, you know, it's everything shuts down except for that one table. You know, they get all the free food, they get all the free drinks, every server, every manager, they're just hovering over the table. And it's as if the other guests of the restaurant don't matter. They don't apply. And I really love the fact that she's created a culture that everyone is equal and everyone should be treated the same and everyone should be treated as though they are the most important guest. So therefore, all of the reservations are only handled on resi.com. So it's an interesting situation because there's only 8 tables at ISOTI. And so you have to, you know, you have to be quick on resi and you have to get them. Now, having said that, there is a bar there with 16 seats. And that's where a lot of our regular guests dine at because it's a walk-in situation. And it kind of takes out the hassle of dealing with resi and trying to get your reservation at the exact time you want. It gives you a much more free opportunity to come by, sit down and have a dinner at the bar. You're going to get the same exact experience, but you're going to get, you're going to have that full dinner. You're going to have everything, but you don't have to deal with the hassle of getting a reservation. So that, and if we are full at the bar, you know, you just put your name in, we text you when the seats are ready. So it's really, I think, a much easier and much more approachable way to dining there versus trying to get one of those 8 tables throughout the night. It's just a very difficult situation. You know, it's don't get me wrong, it's a great problem that we have, but but at the same time, it's not the only way to dine there. And a lot of people, I think that they get fall into that trap that it's the only way I can get to dine at ISOTI is getting a reservation. And that's just not the case.
No, well, I recall going as a walk-in and sitting at the bar, and that's how I got in. And actually, I guess I'm kind of kicking myself to last year in the pandemic when restaurants, you know, like started opening their outdoor spaces. I remember walking down the block and seeing ISOTI's, your setup and being like, oh, I should go there and eat outside because it looks so cozy and quaint. And there were tables, but I didn't grab it, but I'm glad you guys survived through that period.
Yeah, you know, it was a challenging for everyone in the industry, and I'm very grateful that we have such a really wonderful following and loyal guests that have come in, whether they were sitting outside in the freezing cold under those heaters, or they were sitting outside when we first opened in last summer. And, you know, it was kind of cool. It was kind of like you were really felt like you were in Europe with, you know, just the small little banquet tables and an umbrella over your table. And it was just it was a crazy, crazy time. And, you know, we've definitely found more of a semblance of normalcy now with people coming in and dining at the bar and dining at tables. And, you know, thank goodness for all of this, that it's really gotten back to that feel of normalcy. But at the same time, like I said, we're all really grateful that we have such loyal guests because we were having regulars on a weekly basis coming in and having dinner with us during that time. So it was a little bit crazy. Now, to get back to the other question.
Go ahead.
As far as training, you know, it's really also another interesting situation about the restaurant. And it's part of the reason I love working there so much is that everyone there, it's a very, very small staff. And everyone there is a true professional. There's nobody who's been working in the business for like 6 months or a year. Everyone that's behind the bar or on the tables or at the door, everyone has multiple years of experience. And so everyone is kind of, for lack of a better way to say this, just treats the job like an adult would. And so we all demand of each other our best every shift. And so we all work together on understanding spirit knowledge and understanding wine knowledge. And, you know, if there's a new wine on the menu, Rita opens it and lets us taste it so that we all really understand it and we can speak about it. The same goes for spirits. The same goes for cocktails. But it's not, and I've worked in places where it's kind of been over the top where they just pour so much info at you so often that I think a lot of servers, a lot of bartenders, they get either A, overwhelmed and don't bother handling it, or it's just a matter of, you know, you can only hold so much information coming at you so fast. And I've had places where they give you, you know, a sheet at lineup every day with a page worth of information. And it's like, come on, I can't, there's no possible way to maintain all of that information. So I really like that we do it on a much more casual, much more realistic expectation for knowledge. And so I think everybody there is really, again, dialed in and make sure that they know what they need to know, because everybody wants to make sure that we all carry that culture that she has created over the past 13 years, that we all do a really good job and keep doing that. Because at this point, we're the extension of Rita. So she really wants to make sure that we do the same job that she would expect anyone to do in that restaurant. So again, it's a responsibility that we all gladly accept and all hope that we do our best every time.
Yeah, wonderful. So let's talk a bit about Diageo and the world-class competition. Like what led you to compete in that? I mean, you won the national championship in 2017. Like what led you to compete? And then what was the whole process like and your experience as a competitor?
So I started competing in 2014. I was at the time, I was just kind of in the mood to challenge myself. I was finding myself in a little bit of a creativity rut. I was working at a restaurant that didn't really create an environment that felt like you were part of the creativity aspect. You were more or less just a person on their team to make their drinks and take their orders and leave after work. And I just felt like a little bit of a rut, and I felt kind of uninspired. And I said, if I'm going to go for a competition, let me go for the biggest one. And I was really never into bartending competitions. I was into flair competitions, but never cocktail competitions. I didn't really feel that, you know, with drinks are so relative to the person that who's to say that my drink is better than someone else's drink or that person, you know, it's such a relative taste thing that people have biases and people have judgments that I don't like this type of drink, so I'm going to score low. And so I wanted to go to one that I knew would judge fairly, and it would really give me an opportunity to grow, to learn, and to go up against the best of the best. And so in 14, I competed in world class, and it was funny because the regional was in Boston, and I thought I had no shot of getting anywhere in it. So I went there with almost no practice, no preparation, very, very little work of anything. I just kind of wanted to see where I'd stack up. And it was funny because I ended up getting through the regionals and into the nationals, kind of stunning everybody, including judges and friends that were there, like, oh, how did you do it? And I said, I don't know. I just bartended. You know, I just went up there with no nerves, and I just talked to the judges, and I just treated them like they were guests at a bar, and I just had fun with it. And then when I got to the nationals, I found success there too. And I ended up taking fourth overall. And it was just one of those things where I was playing with house money. I didn't have any kind of nerves or anything like that. And I just went up there and bartended like I had always done. So now the next year in 15, I had to eat a little humble pie because I went in there with a little bit more of different attitude. There was a little bit of arrogance. There was a little bit of expectation. And I didn't put the work into finding the success. I just assumed the success would find me like it did the first year. And I ended up not getting through the regional. And I took it very, very hard. And I was very disappointed in myself. But I was more or less disappointed in my attitude than anything else. I realized maybe, you know what, maybe I should have put some work into this. So the following year in 16, I really refocused. I started practicing harder. I started creating concepts and drinks. And I really, I kind of reinvented that training to myself. And I ended up getting through the regional, getting into the nationals, and losing to Andrew Meltzer, who was the guy who won the year prior to me. And it, for whatever reason, something just lit up in me that right when they announced his name, I sat down with a friend of mine outside the ballroom that they announced the winner. And wasn't upset. I wasn't angry. You know, a lot of competitors end up getting into that blaming or finger pointing thing where they say it's not fair. It was rigged. I didn't do any of that. I just said to my friend, I said, next year I'm winning this thing and that's it. Like I'm done. I'm just, this whole year is about winning. And I did. I focused on things that I had never focused before. And it was a really, really cool opportunity and a life-changing opportunity for me, because what happened was I started focusing on the mental aspect that I had never, ever, ever focused on before in competing. Whether it was as a kid, as a hockey player, as a flair bartender in my early 20s, I never, ever focused on the mental preparation aspect. I always focused on the technical aspect only. And so I reached out to some guys who had won big competitions and asked for their help. I started reading books on Olympic world medalists and other people who wrote books on mental training and mental fortitude and grit and all those kind of things. And I kind of refocused my energy instead of what's in the drink into my head. And I started understanding that I had always competed as second best. I had always thought of myself as, well, I won't win, so I don't really need to practice that hard, or vice versa in a little subconscious way. What I started thinking was, I can't win, so I won't practice hard, therefore I'll have an out when I don't win, to kind of give myself that excuse, oh, I could have won, but I didn't really try my hardest and that kind of thing. So a little bit of a kind of a sort of a cushion for failure. And so I finally realized all those things about myself. And I said, okay, this time I'm going to go for it, but in a different way. I started realizing that most athletes don't actually compete to win. They compete to be exceptional for how they practice. They want to be perfect for their skill set. So I started practicing that way, and I started thinking about things that way. And I practiced probably harder than I'd ever practiced for any competition combined, all of them together in that 1 year. And I went up there, and all I wanted to do was just create the rounds of world class, those five rounds in the national finals. I just wanted to be perfect for how I practiced. And I said to myself, if everything is executed exactly how I want it, then I don't care if I win or lose. And it was the first time I had ever done that in a competition, that kind of thinking. It was just be perfect for what you want to do. And I did. And I went through all the five challenges, and I said to myself after each one, okay, that's another one that went exactly how I wanted it. I wouldn't change a thing. And I don't care how I'm judged, because I know what I did, and I know how I did my best for that day. And when I won, it was interesting, because I had another thing I had practiced was mental imaging and imagining winning prior to. I found that was a very, very common thread between professional athletes and Olympic medalists and other even business leaders, is that you imagine what you want, and you do it so often that when it happens, you're not actually surprised by it. And so it was funny, because the girls that were in charge of world class that year both came up to me and were like, are you okay after I won? Because I wasn't smiling. I was just very like stoic. And I said to them, I said, I'm really happy. I'm not surprised by this. I had already seen it in my head, and it's happening exactly how I envisioned it. So it was a really, really cool ride. And it was, like I said, it was a life-changing moment, because now everything I do, I try to bring that same energy. So even for this podcast, you know, I started thinking about what I wanted to say and try to envision the podcast before it happened, so I didn't feel nervous. I didn't feel unsure of what I want to say and all those things. But I do that even with work. You know, it's just become a lifestyle thing now. It's just so much more mental than I have never been before.
Yeah. Well, that's amazing. And it's good advice to anyone listening about, you know, getting mentally prepared and what it takes to, you know, to, It's not just about winning. It's about the process and what it means to you. And you certainly found that in doing so. So that's really cool.
Right.
What's your involvement now with Diageo Bar Academy? I know you're on the website as an expert. So what's your role, and tell us a little bit about what all the different master classes and things that Diageo offers, because
yeah,
I get lost in their website. There's so much content.
It is a wealth of knowledge on that website.
Yeah, it's amazing.
I hate that term expert, because it goes back to that thing that, you know, it, when you start calling yourself an expert is when you stop working on things. And so one of the things I've always tried to do is I've tried to maintain a level of understanding that there is always someone who knows more than you, and there is always someone to reach out to when you have questions. And I think that not just in the bartending world, but in society, I think we've all started to fall into this trap that you have to be an expert, and you can't ever make a mistake, and you can't ever ask for help, and you can't ever say, I don't know. And I think it's a really big it's just a trap that we all have fallen into, thinking that you have to know everything. And I try not to ever feel like that. So there's so many people between flair bartenders and cocktail bartenders and just understanding things about life, people that I reach out to for so many different areas of questions, even during the pandemic, about how to bottle cocktails and how to carbonate cocktails and things that I don't do on a regular basis. I would, you know, text them and say, hey, you got 5 minutes? I have some questions I need help with, understanding all of that kind of stuff. So the Bar Academy is just an amazing resource for bartenders, or I guess enthusiasts too, where you can learn. There's so many opportunities to get better in every single aspect of the industry. And it's, like I said, it's a rare thing because there aren't many places for bartenders to go to learn about. It doesn't just have to be about brands and flavors. It can be about trends and techniques and high-level concepts, rudimentary concepts. It just gives you an overall opportunity to really better yourself in the industry. So I really, really am excited about the Bar Academy. And I've done a few things for them. The one thing I'm very excited about, I'm doing a masterclass on January 11th for balance. It's called Balance and Bright, but it's basically understanding how to integrate seasonal low ABV or no ABV cocktails at your bar for the winter. And so I'm really, really excited about that because the low ABV / mocktail, non-alcoholic cocktail, whatever you want to call them, has become a really big trend. And I'm excited about it because there's a lot of pressure in the business, whether you're in the industry or out of the industry, to drink. And I like the fact that people are understanding that that pressure is unnecessary and that you don't need to drink to either A, have a good time if you're a guest, or B, to drink if you're in the industry and be successful. For a long, long time before I stopped drinking, I thought that that was a mandatory part of it, that if you want to be a great bartender, you also have to be a great drinker. And that was subconsciously kind of driven by so many messages from other bartenders and guests and just society in general. And I'm really glad that we're all, as a group, as a society, coming around to that notion that you don't have to drink if you don't want to have a great time or to be a great bartender. So I'm very, very excited for that masterclass.
Oh, amazing. I didn't know you didn't drink. I don't drink either. And so I am very familiar with the space and what it's been like over the years to go out and be someone who doesn't want alcohol, and how there's been a shift. And it's very interesting. We'll talk more later in the industry news about what's been happening, change in the industry, because it was a good article that came out. But it's great you're providing a class on that, because I'm also finding now, it's interesting because now, meaning like the past few months, I dine out a lot, and I'm actually to the point where when I look at the cocktail menu, if there isn't a little section on booze free, zero proof, whatever fun name you want to call it, drinks, like there's usually now I find like two or three at a lot of the restaurants, but when it's not there, I'm actually a little disappointed. I'm like, don't you know what's happening in the industry?
Yeah. It's like I said, it's a very, very important aspect. And you know, I understand what you're saying about feeling like, you know, everyone should have that. And I also understand the other side of it where, you know, you have to reprint menus, you have to think about space and all that kind of stuff. But even if you don't print it, to be available to your guests and say, when they say, oh, I'm not drinking tonight, I'm just going to have water, to offer them something. Or if they ask you, you know, do you offer mocktails? Do you have any drinks, that kind of stuff? You know, to be able to say, yes, we do have that, and to be able to create something for them that they're going to enjoy and they're going to feel just as excited about as an alcoholic cocktail is so important. I'm fully with you, for sure.
Yes. And over the years, and I still do, I've had bartenders make me mocktails just on the fly. That's wonderful. And again, going back to your class, that you're teaching this, that people will be able to make better ones, you know, in over the years even. But I think the thing with seeing it on the menu, it's almost like if I see it on the menu, it's going to drive more sales, I think. I've said this to a couple people when I've been dining out, because like you see it and it's sort of like, oh, that looks good, I'll get it, versus like asking separately. But it's interesting. It's interesting to see this shift. And that's very cool that you have that coming up. Before we take a break, just one other thing I want to ask you about with flair bartending, because it's not something, I mean, like what is happening with flair bartending? Because I don't think that's trending now. I don't know will that be something that comes back at some point as we see more at bars? Because I think right now it's kind of more low key bartending.
Yeah, it's really interesting the cycles that happen in this industry. It's really interesting because flair bartending was all the rage in the early 2000s. I mean, if you didn't flair bartend, it was like you were missing on the boat. And then it just kind of, I mean, I saw the writing on the wall as cocktails just started exploding. Flair kind of went the other way. And then flair kind of vanished. And there, you know, there's pockets of the country that still do a lot of flair bartending. But the thing that I found with flair bartending as it was defined in the early 2000s was that it was much more available for places where you're on vacation, you're not in a rush, you're here for a show, and you're here to relax. So places like Las Vegas are built for flair bartending, right? People go to Vegas for the shows that they want to see. So it's perfect fit to go to a bar when you're not in a rush, you're on vacation, and you'll watch a flair bartender flip around bottles and put on a big show. The problem is that that's not real life in an everyday aspect. So in New York, trying to flair bartend is like, you're going to get, you know, people are going to not only give you rude comments, but they're going to give you angry faces. And, you know, they're going to be not really thrilled with the fact that they feel like you're kind of showing off. So what's been interesting about flair is that over the past year or so, it's kind of gotten through Instagram, TikTok videos, all that kind of stuff. It's sort of building this weird, like, underground cult thing that I've watched it sort of swell. And people are trying to learn how to flair in a more realistic way. So there's always been kind of two flares. There's been exhibition flair, which is, again, what you see in Cocktail, the movie, or in Vegas. And then there's working flair that a lot of bartenders, even in cocktail bars, have taken on, where things, the way you manipulate your jiggers, your bar spoons, the way you pick up your tins, the way you shake your drink, the way you strain your drink. There's a lot of these little very, very subtle, intricate movements that people, in like lay people, don't notice, but bartenders will be like, oh, you know, that was cool, I saw that. And it's again, it's there's sort of like very, like, very gentle, quiet underswell that's been happening about it. And I think that it's going to continue, and eventually it will sort of overtake again, because it's just cyclical, right? You have cocktails are more important, then you have entertainment's more important, then you have cocktails are more important. And I think at some point people are going to say, wait a minute, I want to be entertained by the bartender again, and cocktails will sort of die down. And we're already seeing that a little bit, right? That sort of snooty, arrogant mixologist is kind of snubbed at now. We don't want that anymore. We want the bartender who's much more down to earth. We want to sort of go to those dive bars again. So we're going in that direction where entertainment and fun is being the focus again at the bar. But I don't think we'll ever get back to that, like, you know, bottle juggling, crazy Vegas stuff, except in those pockets that are designed for that purpose. Yeah.
Except in Vegas. What happens in Vegas stays in Vegas.
Including for that.
Awesome. Okay, so let's take a little break, and we'll come back. We'll play my speed round game. We'll talk some industry news. I have my solo dining experience this week, and the final question. So stay with us. This is All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. Are your menus ready for colder weather? Seasonal serves can drive hot profits. Sign up at DiageoBarAcademy.com to join experts live, or view past master classes on demand to learn how to create the ultimate seasonal cocktail menu with tips and techniques and how to stay on trend to make your bar more profitable. Also, learn how to create a menu that includes warming, spice-infused drinks, as well as low or no ABV winter cocktails, and how to integrate mindful drink styles into your beverage programs. Whether you are a bartender, owner, or operator, or if you are completely new to the industry, Diageo Bar Academy has easy-to-access resources to help you learn new skills or stay in the loop with all the latest industry trends. So why wait? Visit DiageoBarAcademy.com. That's D-I-A-G-E-O BarAcademy.com. Become a member and sign up for the newsletter today. It's completely free, and you will be amazed at all they have to offer. That's D-I-A-G-E-O BarAcademy.com. Welcome back to All in the Industry on Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Sherry Bayer. My guest today is Chris Cardone. He's a bartender with lots of experience. He's currently bartending at Isodi in New York City, and he is the 2017 National Champion of Diageo World Class. So, Chris, it's time for my speed round game. What this is I'm going to name a couple of things, and you get to pick your preference, such as chocolate or vanilla. Are you ready?
I'm ready. I won speed round in world class two times, so let's bring it on, Sherry. Give me your best of your best.
All right. Here we go. Eat in at home or eat out at a restaurant?
Eat in at home since the pandemic.
Gotcha. Indoor dining or al fresco dining?
Indoor.
Wine, beer, cocktail, mocktail, or champagne?
Mocktail.
We have a whole conversation about people not liking the word mocktail that came up once, but I still use it. Okay, keep going. Tasting menu or a la carte?
Oh, that's tough. All right, I'll go tasting menu because I think that it offers a more exciting experience if it's executed perfectly.
Great. How about small plates or large plates?
Small plates.
Communal table or chef's counter?
Communal table.
Tipping or all-inclusive charge?
Tipping, 100%. Stop this all-inclusive.
Spoken like a true bartender. Okay, how about cocktail or Coyote Ugly? Talking about the movies.
Oh, cocktail, for sure.
I mean, it's such a classic. I mean, whenever you talk about, or whenever at least I think of flair bartending, I immediately go to Tom Cruise.
You know, it's funny because the movie is kind of a joke. You know, a lot of people make comments about Coyote, but if you watch that movie and you've bartended for more than a couple of years, that movie is scary accurate about actually how that world works. There's a really amazing scene. I know this is speed round, but there's a really amazing scene where Tom Cruise and Elizabeth Chu are talking about his dreams and becoming a millionaire and finding his thing. And he describes bartending and how you get hooked into it. I mean, it's beautiful and it's so scary accurate.
Yeah, no, it's a fabulous movie. I mean, it's a cheesy, fabulous movie, but kind of love it. And now I'm going to look for that scene next time it comes on TV. It's probably going to be on like this weekend.
Yeah, or somewhere.
Okay, I got three more. This might be the toughest one. Via Carota, Bouvet, or Pesolino.
Oh, I see how you stole one. You left one out.
Should I put Isotti in there?
Yeah, of course. So Isotti for sure.
I was giving the other, well, yeah. I mean, I was thinking if you're not eating at Isotti.
I really do. I really do love them all. It's really hard for me to pick one, to be perfectly honest. I think they all have different aspects to be charming. I think there's some really, really beautiful parts about all of them. And I think they execute what they do the best. But I will say there's something about Bouvet at brunch that is like magical. And I really, truly love that experience. Everything about that experience at brunch for Bouvet, I every time I've left, I've kind of like had a smile on my face that is just like, wow, that was really good. So I'll pick that just because I have to. But I think, like I said, I have so much respect for all three spots because they do what they do really well.
Yes. Oh my God. I love brunch at Bouvet. And yeah, I don't know. It's a tough one. And these are Rita's part with her partner, Jody Williams restaurants for people who might not be familiar, and they're all down in the village and they're all fabulous. Okay, two more. I got cheese plate or dessert?
Dessert.
Manhattan or Brooklyn?
Oh, Manhattan for sure.
Terrific. That's the game.
That was fun.
You win. So the prize is, though, my prize is kind of lame right here. It's to talk some industry news.
Okay.
But interestingly enough, this week there was an article in Business Insider, and the title is Wellness-Focused, Sober Curious Consumers Are Driving Interest in Booze-Free Cocktails, a Relative Newcomer to the $180 billion Beverage Industry. This was by Alana Akhtar. So it's what we've been talking about on the show. This was saying non-alcoholic beverage sales increased 33% to 331 million this last year. And analysts are saying that non-alcoholic spirits will continue to grow in 2022. Sober, curious young people and wellness-minded drinkers are contributing to the non-alcoholic drink movement. So, let's talk a little bit more about what you're seeing with the industry. And because I hate to say it's a trend, especially as someone who hasn't drank alcohol in a long time, because to me, it's not a trend. It's just a lifestyle. But it is, I guess, trending. Do we think this is here to last? My guess is yes.
Yes and no, I think. I think that there are trends that do take place in our society, right? So you think about the trend of society when they look at things that were very expensive that they used to buy, and then there was a very quick trend of just buying cheap, inexpensive things, and then that got pushed back into quality. And so there's always ebbs and flows, right? So the industry for alcohol will be the same thing. There will be times where cocktails are more popular, and then wine is more popular. There will be times where people drink heavier, and then that over 10, 15 years has an effect on the next generation who doesn't drink as heavy. So there will always be ebbs and flows in the trends. What I don't think is a trend is that I think as a society and as an industry, there's more of an acceptance on people who don't drink. Now, granted, there will always be people who will push back on that, just like everything else. You know, as society grows and matures, I don't know if mature is the right word, but it feels like matures, you know, when you feel like you got to pressure somebody to drink or not. But as society becomes more acceptable, we'll say, about other people's opinions and other people's choices, there's always growth. There's always a little bit of pushback from people who aren't willing to change or don't want to change or afraid of change. But I don't think that's a trend. I don't think that we'll ever get back to a place where the overwhelming majority feels that they have to drink, and that they are kind of forced into drinking, or they're not cool if they don't drink. I think those days luckily are over, but I do think that there will be, you know, there will be reactions and ebbs and flows to it. I think right now we're watching a younger generation. You know, I hate to generalize and call it millennials, but a younger generation doesn't drink as much as an older generation does. I see that certainly during service on a nightly basis. And understanding that it's just what's happening in their lives, how they choose to go out and enjoy themselves, to be accepting of it and to offer them alternative options like non-alcoholic cocktails, or just to be accepting that they're just going to have water tonight and not snub them, treat them any different or anything like that, is I think that is something that's going to stay. And then as far as non-alcoholic ingredients like Seed Lip and other non-alcoholic distilled spirits, offering lots of different tonics and club sodas and flavored non-alcoholic drinks and all that stuff, I think that is an industry that's going to continue to grow because, again, it does give people options. And it also, to be quite frank, it doesn't have to necessarily only be non-alcoholic options. So, for example, I always get excited when I see a new ingredient from Fever Tree or a new ingredient from, like, let's say the Pellegrino sodas. I get excited because I'm like, oh, what can I use that for both? You know, I use it as a non-alcoholic option, but I also figure out a way to use it in a cocktail too and use it for, you know, two birds with one stone. So I applaud and I'm very excited about all the different flavors of ingredients that are coming out that are not spirit-based.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. And yeah, Seed Lip was, they talked about in this article, and Diageo acquired Seed Lip several years ago. And definitely, I stopped by the other day. There's a store in New York. There's a couple of them, but it's called, I say Boysen or Busan. And it's a non-alcoholic, liquor store. It was like a candy store for someone who doesn't drink. I was very impressed with the amount of products they had and the layout and their knowledge about everything that was offered. And I also work with Curious Elixirs, which is a non-alcoholic craft cocktail, one of the first pioneers in this space, and it's been amazing to see their success and just the continued interest in people excited about trying non-alcoholic spirits. So I think I agree with you. I think we are going to start seeing more, and it is exciting when new products come out. So we can stay tuned for that. And yeah, so that was my industry news. And then for my solo dining experience this week, here's the rundown. It's at Kesti Pizza and Vino. The location, 66 Gold Street off of Fulton Street in downtown Manhattan. The concept is real Neapolitan pizza. The chef and owner is Roberto Caporuccio. I should always practice this ahead. I look at it, staring at it. I know Roberto, but I'm just going to say chef and owner Roberto. Why did I go? I'm a fan of Kesti and Roberto, and he invited me to try some new dishes on their menu. So I went this weekend. My experience, I was warmly greeted by his team. I said hello to him and sat at a table near the kitchen. And usually my solo dining experiences, I'm just going anonymously. No one knows I'm there. But this was one that I was invited in, and I enjoyed it, and I felt I wanted to talk about it because I'll tell you what I got. The reason he invited me in was he had all these new menu items, most of them gluten-free, which amazingly, he said that 40% of his pizza now at the restaurant, he said 40% of the orders are for gluten-free pizza, which he's offering. So I had that easy. I didn't try one of the gluten-free ones. I did have a calzone that he was doing, and I had some Italian traditional meatballs, the polpette, and I had a basil cream lasagna with homemade basil and creme de insiera la fignolina, I'm saying that correctly. Those were both gluten-free. And then the pizza I got was this Sabrina pizza, which was with truffle cream base, homemade four cheeses, basil, extra virgin olive oil, imported salami, and fresh shaved truffles on top from Urbani. And then I also got to try the tiramisu, which was gluten-free. And I got an espresso, some sparkling water. And then he sent me home with a frozen pizza. So it was like crazy. I had this amazing experience. My favorites, my take, I'd say the meatball with the red sauce was outstanding. I really liked the lasagna and the pizza was with the truffles. I mean, you can't go wrong when someone's like shaving fresh truffles on top of your pizza. So it was really fabulous. The ambiance. So there's a few eating areas. This is their location downtown, and it has some warm wood tones, exposed brick. It's very unpretentious. And there's a separate room where he does pizza classes, and there's also outdoor dining. Perfect for dinner with friends, family, or date night. I saw all of that happening around me. Interesting tidbit. So Kesti is now offering their frozen pizzas for nationwide shipping. And just FYI, they closed their location on Bleecker Street, which was the original one. And Roberto is no longer involved with Don Antonio. So this is his only spot. And Kesti means this is it. And Roberto serves as the U.S. president of Italy's Association of Neapolitan Pizzioli. So he's the real deal. Personal fun fact, I met Roberto a few years ago when I was doing PR for the opening of Sorbillo on Bowery, which was very respected, famous pizzaiolo Gino Sorbillo brought his pizza to New York. That's when we met. And the cost of this meal, it was comped. I was a guest, so I didn't get a bill. I left a nice tip. I'm guessing it was probably about like $75, $80 worth of food, just FYI. Would I go back? Yes. And their website is kestepizzeria.com and Instagram is kestepizza. And that's K-E-S-T-E.
Thanks so much to Roberto and his team for having me in. Grazie mille.
So there you go. Have you been there before, Chris? Kesti?
No, I haven't. Sounds great, actually. That sounds like a really nice experience. I was very surprised when you said 40% of their sales is gluten-free pizza. That's a very high number. That's very surprising. I get all excited about stuff like that because I have a personal connection to something like that. My daughter has a severe nut allergy, and it's so nice over the past, she's 11 now, and over the past 11 years, what I've seen as far as change in both restaurants, but also just food packaging and being understanding that food allergies and insensitivities is a real thing, and it's not something that people joke about or just kind of brush off, and it's been really, really nice. I remember when she was very young, we went to a restaurant and asked if the ingredients were safe for her. And the server was like, yeah, I think so, and kind of walked away. And now it's taken so seriously. So when you said 40%, I was like, wow, it's amazing how much of a, you know, just between gluten and nut allergies and other food intolerances and things like that has become such an important aspect in training and offering and service. So I was very surprised.
Yeah, no, it was amazing. I mean, when he invited me in, he said he had new items on the menu, and I didn't know that I was going to be trying all these gluten-free dishes. And I'm okay with gluten, but I'm happy to not eat gluten too. And I don't think, I think it's pretty cool that he is focused on this. And I think it would be a great place for you to take your daughter. So, but that quick question with Isodi, do you have gluten-free pastas?
We don't have gluten-free pasta, but we have a lot of gluten-free options. So the entire Secondi menu, the entire protein menu is all gluten-free. And the appetizers, every one of them can be gluten-free. Some of them, like a tartare, comes with some toast, but obviously that can either be, you know, omitted from the dish or just put on another plate. So there's tons of options. We actually had a lot of gluten-free guests who come in and just get Secondis and things like that and really enjoy it.
Fabulous. Well, good to know. Okay, so it's time for the final question. So my next guest is Lori Wolliver. She is a writer and editor. She's the former lieutenant to the late author, TV host, and producer Anthony Bourdain. Lori has written several books, including Appetites and World Travel and Irreverent Guide, which she co-wrote with Anthony Bourdain. And her new book out is Bourdain, The Definitive Oral Biography. I've known Lori for a while. I'm looking forward to speaking with her, and I would love for you to ask her a question, Chris.
So, sure. Let's see. I mean, I'm always interested in understanding the intention of a human being, right? So what I think I'd love to understand is her interpretation of what Anthony was, his intention really was with all of his shows and all of his information that he gave all of us. You know, he seemed in his shows to be very authentic, really interested, and really involved in so many projects, so many different cultures and styles and all that stuff. So I'd love to see what her interpretation was of his sort of, let's use the Simon Sinek concept of his why, right? What was he trying to accomplish? What was his heart telling him to do versus just, you know, there's so many people who just go out and do their thing and they don't really have an intention. They just kind of fall into a trap of just doing their job and that's kind of it. He didn't seem like that. So I'd love her interpretation on what his intention of what he was trying to do, what that really was for him, what his drive was.
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, it's a great question. I'm looking forward to talking with her. I think it might be a little bit of a heavier show, but she's worked with him for a long time. So so that will be my next one. Stay tuned for that. I will ask her. And that's this show. Thank you so much, Chris.
I
look forward to meeting you in person, and I have to come down and get a seat at the bar at Isodi. So you can see, maybe you'll do a little flair bartending back there for me. I'm just kidding.
quietly.
Little flip behind the back. No, I'm just teasing. Congratulations on all your success and everything you're doing. And thank you so much.
Again, thank you so much for having me and giving me the opportunity to discuss this stuff with you. Thank you.
Oh, you're welcome. My guest today has been Chris Cardone. He's a bartender with over 21 years of experience. He's currently working at Isodi in New York City, and he is the 2017 national champion of Diageo World Class. You can find him websites isodinyc.com. That's an isodinyc.com. You can also go to DiageoBarAcademy.com. Check it out. There's so much content on there. It's an amazing resource. It's really fabulous. And on social media at DiageoBarAC, at Chris Cardone. But I have to ask you this, Chris. Your Instagram handle, your O is a zero.
Yes, that's right. because I'm edgy.
Okay, that's what it looks like on Instagram. So Chris Cardone with a zero as the O. And you can also follow Rita Sodi. You can follow me at Sherry Bayer at Bayer PR and at All Industry. My Facebook page is All in the Industry. Websites are BayerPublicRelations.com, SherryBayer.com, and AllInTheIndustry.com. All of our shows are archived at HeritageRadioNetwork.org. We are also on iTunes, Stitcher, and Spotify. Thanks to my engineer today, Armen, and thanks again to Chris, and thanks to Laurel. I'm your host and producer, Sherry Bayer. I will be back next week with a new show. Hope you'll tune in then, and thank you for being part of All in the Industry. Bye. All in the Industry is powered by Simplecast. I'm Sherry Bayer, and you're listening to Heritage Radio Network, a member-supported podcast network broadcasting over 35 weekly shows live from Bushwick, Brooklyn. This year, HRN is celebrating 10 years of food radio. For the past decade, we've been taking you behind the scenes of farms, restaurants, breweries, school cafeterias, and more. It's been 10 years, and we're just getting started. Learn more at heritageradionetwork.org.
Hi, listeners. We want to tell you about a podcast we're really digging. It's called Christopher Kimball's Milk Street Radio. Every week, they travel the world to find the most fascinating stories about food, including children who harvest cod tongues after school in Norway and a detective who tracks down food thieves. And on Milk Street Radio, you can always find the unexpected. The comedian who ranks apples using an elaborate 100-point system, the secret history of grocery stores, and how to eat your way through Italy. They also interview the most beloved names in food like Jacques Pepin, Sola Aweli, Jose Andres, Jet Tila, Ina Garten, Nigella Lawson, and Padma Lakshmi. Plus, co-hosts Christopher Kimball and Sarah Moulton do live calls with listeners and answer their questions about ingredients, techniques, and culinary mysteries, like why roasting a leg of lamb made one caller's oven explode. Ever wonder why your bread won't rise or your souffle falls flat? Chris and Sarah have the answers. You'll also hear from a rotating cast of contributors, including Kenji Lopez-Alt, Cheryl Day, Dan Pashman from The Sporkful, and Alex Inouz, a French guy cooking from YouTube. Take a listen at 177milkstreet.com/radio or just search your podcast app for Milk Street Radio.